We're going to resume our Old Testament survey today and really go back a little bit and look at the sort of the tail end of some of the material we were doing last week about the entrance of sin, and then go in to the promises to Abraham. So let's start with a prayer. Zachary, would you lead our thoughts, please?
Our dear Lord and our gracious Father in heaven, we're so grateful for this day, for this Lord's Day that we have to gather here to worship you now to study your word. We ask you to help us to be attentive in this study and to seek to learn as much as we can about what you would have us to know. We ask you to help us to understand your word and to gain wisdom and knowledge of you. And we ask you to be with Philip as he leads us in this study, that he would present his material and manner that is clear and is accurate in accordance with your word. We thank you for all that you bless us with and all that you give us each day. It's in Jesus' name that we pray. Amen.
Amen. So keep in mind in this survey, what we're trying to do is keep the big picture before us, and the main focus, of course, is what the Old Testament is revealing about God. He is the centerpiece. He is the main character. And then spinning off of that, what, in addition to what we're learning about God, what are we learning about God and his relationships with his interactions with human beings? And we have a lot of examples in the Old Testament regarding how that works. But along the way, we do have to manage our information. And so that's why you have this packet. And so if you're doing the packet, it's there for your, if you prefer to do that. If you're doing the packet, we've got some things we want to make sure that we're getting on the packet. So there are five key passages that we're emphasizing in this survey. And the first we saw 2 weeks ago, and that is the entrance of sin into the world in Genesis chapter 3. And specifically, part of what's going on in Genesis chapter 3 is not just the catastrophe of humans rebelling against God and suffering for it, but also what God is doing in response to it, which also doesn't happen just in the garden at the episode of the fall into sin, but as the New Testament later tells us, that it is connected to an eternal plan. So it's the statement in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, that is sort of a crux in this chapter. Rick, would you read that verse for us, Genesis 3, verse 15, and keep in mind the who, the what, and even the wind.
And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel.
As a consequence of Adam and Eve sinning, who is God speaking to here? In verse 15. The serpent, who we come to understand is Satan. And who else is talked about here? The serpent is talked about, but who else is referenced? The seed of woman, the offspring of woman, okay? You and the woman, okay? Between your offspring and her offspring. So, we're talking about Satan and an offspring of woman. Now, that's vague, isn't it? You and I are the offspring of women. And is there anything said about a time frame, about a when in this declaration? Nothing. Okay. So this is what we talked about the other day, that this is much like the illustration that you're standing in a lit hallway and you crack a door to a dark room. And when you just open the door a little bit, a sliver of light comes in. How much can you see? Very little. And so watch in the Bible how that God opens the door to his plan, and light a little bit at a time floods in, and you begin to see what God's going to do. This, at this point, it's very dark and murky. We just know that God has a plan to counter the work of Satan against human beings. And that work will include the absolute destruction of Satan. Although along the way, some seed of woman will be bruised in the process. But his bruising is linked to the destruction, the blow to the head, of Satan. Let it stay vague. You probably know where it's going, but let that, you know, stay there. Well, the other thing that we did last week, and by the way, let's go ahead and update our timeline. And if you haven't updated the timeline, this is what we've been putting on it. We saw the creation, we saw the emergence of Adam and Eve, the first humans, and then this critical event, sin entering the world in Genesis chapter 3. But we saw the proliferation of sin. Cain killing Abel. The flood, because the whole world had become so wicked. And then the Tower of Babel, which is post the flood, but it was humans trying to elevate themselves and grow in their pride and their arrogance and so forth. But it's that flood that's the big event between the creation and the call to Abraham that we're going to look at today. And so we quickly talked about the flood. But the flood brings on something significant here, okay, for us, and we're going to note that. But in addition to the curse of Satan, the curse of the serpent, this interaction with Noah also is involved in the continual work of God. Because what God illustrates is two things. Is when he sees wickedness flourish, he punishes and judges wickedness. But in the case of Noah and his family, what did he do? He saved them. So God's always working in judgment and punishment and deliverance and salvation to create for himself something that's left over. A remnant. A people that will still be his people, though most will not. And so watch that pattern all through the Old Testament as well as into the New Testament. So look with me to Genesis 9 real quickly here, because there is actually the next covenant. We'll plot that in a moment. But Genesis 9 is post-flood, and Noah and his family emerge from the ark. And look what God says to them. Dave, will you read Genesis 9, verse 8 and 9? Genesis 9, 8 and 9 for us.
To the God said to Noah and to his sons with him, behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you.
All right, look at this. I'm going to make a covenant with you. So, you know this probably, okay? If you do, in Genesis chapter 9, humans were told they could do what now after the flood? What are they to do that's like something that God has already said to Adam and Eve? Go and multiply. It's like God's hitting reset in Genesis 9 here. Back to Genesis 2 and 1. Okay, I've started over with another family that's going to populate the earth. Okay, and then there's God's involvement. What does God promise in Genesis 9?
Never flood again.
Never flood again. And what's the token, what's the symbol that he gives? The rainbow in the sky. I'm not going to destroy the earth again with water. That's what he promises there. And look what God calls this with Noah and his descendants. He calls it a covenant. So you can flip over to your covenant page. Covenant, if you're a Bible student, covenant is a term that you run into. Covenant is a term that's thrown around. And there are certain times where we apply the term covenant. I would have you see the term covenant is broader maybe than sometimes we think. He really has a covenant with Adam. To bless Adam and provide for Adam as Adam and Eve multiply and tend the garden and all the things they do. But now, he actually says to Noah, in a very similar kind of covenant that he makes with Noah's family, that he made with Adam and Eve, I have a covenant with you. I want you to multiply. I'm going to provide for you. You can eat the flesh as well as the plants now. And I'm going to promise not to destroy the world with flood. So there is actually a covenant made with Noah. And remember what a covenant is. It's a binding agreement. Both parties have obligations. And if there is a violation of the covenant, one or two parties will suffer some consequence to it. It's an agreement. It's a legally binding agreement, so to speak. And as we're about to leave the sin entrance into the world section, which indeed, Genesis 3 is when sin comes into the world and Adam and Eve rebel against God's will. I want you to see that really it's Genesis 3 through 11 that it reverberates. What happens in the garden with the tree of the knowledge of good and evil reverberates through Cain and Abel, through the wickedness in Noah's day, and all the way down through the Tower of Babel incident. So as you're reading these first three chapters of Genesis, it's a little troubling, isn't it? But leave it to God to start steering this in another direction. Well, before we leave the sin entrance thing, I want you to throw these things up for you. One is, we see definitely in the case of Adam and Eve with Cain, with Noah's world, with the Tower of Babel constructors, that sin has permanent consequences, but may not have permanent guilt. And the reason I say that is, if Satan is going to be destroyed, which that means his work will be destroyed, then there's hope for human beings. That if they follow after Satan, there's hope to be redeemed or saved or delivered from that. So understand this, that just because you're guilty of sin and suffer for it, God is trying to find a way to lift the guilt of sin off human beings. Second of all, God is searching and he's trying to provide for his righteous minority. The remnant or the righteous minority is a constant theme in the Old Testament. And I want you to follow that in the back of your head, because in the sermon today, we're going to come to that point. A righteous minority. That is a consistent motif or pattern. And that God purges to do two things. And you see the end of the Old Testament is happening too. And you especially see it illustrated in the work of the prophets and the teachings of the prophets. And that is, as God is judging, he's also providing salvation for those who would repent. And watch how God does both. You know, people who talk about, well, the God of the Old Testament is vengeful and mean and punishing. That's only part of the story. First of all, he's not mean. But he does punish. And he does destroy. But right alongside, and sometimes in the very same event that he's punishing and destroying and judging, he's trying to save someone. So that's the whole story, to be fair, about the God of the Old Testament. And in the face of human sin, God is working to recreate, rebirth and restore. And that's why the Noah incident is really illustrative of that. Because you got the whole world being destroyed, but not the whole world, not everybody, not all the people. Noah and his family are saved because they had faith. According to what Hebrews says, 11th chapter, Noah had faith and did what God told him to do, and they were saved. All right. Are you, any comments on the, as we leave the sin introduction into the world section of the Old Testament? You know, think of it, anybody who writes a good story or a screenplay or a play, something happens early on. Something bad happens. Some problem occurs. And the rest of the story is, how is this going to be addressed? How is this going to be solved? It's exactly what you see in the Bible. Sin has now doomed humans. Are they doomed eternally, or is there yet hope? Is God going to do something for them? Any observation before we go to Abraham? Okay. Let's go to the next major part of the Old Testament narrative. And we're introduced to this man who is first called Abram. And much like you see in several places in the book of Genesis, he starts off with one name and then he's given another name. He is then called Abraham. So we may refer to him as Abram or Abraham, meaning father of many. And this is a summary of who Abraham is. And sometimes we think about the end of Abraham and we don't think about the whole of Abraham. Abraham, we could consider him a pagan at the beginning. He's living in Mesopotamia. Now, if you've watched the video that Ken and I made, and shall I say Ken made, and I sort of helped him with it, really, he put more hours probably in it than I did, then you know something about Mesopotamia, the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley. What was this area like in the history of the world?
Seat of creation, really.
Okay. Early events of the book of Genesis are happening in that area. But you pick up any world history book, within pages, you're taken to Mesopotamia. The sail, the wheel, and writing are all believed to have started in Mesopotamia. Whoa. Sometimes it's called the cradle of civilization. So Abraham lived in the place where it was happening. He lived in the United States of his day. Why do all people in the world want to come to the United States? Because this is where the cutting edge things are happening. Okay, it was Britain in the 19th century. Okay, it was China in the 9th century. It was the place where humans were really progressing and accomplishing a lot. And God calls this man to leave that and to go to a backwater. Get it? Because God had something greater in store for him than just human civilization and all that it can accomplish. So he comes and makes himself known to this God, to this man, God does, and he calls him to leave there and go to a land that he had never seen before. He'd never visited and moved there. And that this was predicated on promises that he would bless him and his descendants after him. Now that's unusual because at this time, how many descendants did Abraham have when God came to him? None. And generally, his age was what? Was he older or younger than Hilton? What do you think?
Older.
Older. Really? Yeah. Yeah, he's probably 80 at this point, something like that. But so he's not a young guy like Hilton. He's up in years, okay? Because by this point, they're not living like they did in the days of Noah and Methuselah. They're not living that long. Okay. So, God chose him to start a family, and even the whole notion of a family was linked to faith, because he had no children. And so from the get-go, Abraham is really having to trust God. Here, the biblical story starts off with Adam and Eve not trusting God at all. I mean, in the garden incident, they're not. I'd say they hadn't before, but with this great tragedy of mistrust of God, not trusting what he said and what he said would happen. And now God is looking for this person who will want a relationship with God based on total trust. And so he's looking for a man of faith out of which he can make a family of faith, out of which he can make a people of faith. And I just throw Galatians 3 up there because if we're going to keep the big picture in mind, it's appropriate to reference the New Testament occasionally as the New Testament links all this together. And what Galatians 3, 26 to 29 is teaching us, that even if you're a Gentile and you're not in the lineage of Abraham, that if you have faith in Christ, you're a son or daughter of Abraham. It's an incredible concept. And you are because of faith. So it's a big deal. So here's Mesopotamia. He actually travels out of Ur. Again, Ur's one of the big metropolitan areas. People who don't even touch a Bible, who know about this time in history, know about Ur. It was one of the happening places. Technology and population and organization. And he's called to leave there actually with his father to go to Haran, which is up at the apex of the Fertile Crescent that we talked about in the video. And it's from Haran that then he's called also to go down into Canaan. So the developments here is that his father, sorry about that scramble there, his father moved from Ur to Haran and then on from there. So Ur of the Chaldees is what that says, Chaldea. So, Abraham is called to have faith in God and go and take everything he has, his family, his possessions, his wife and his household, servants and so forth, other relatives are connected to Abraham like Lot and his flocks, and go to a land that he'd never seen. So I think pretty much everybody here, if you've ever moved, you didn't move to a place you never saw. So there are people in Eastern Europe right now that are having to flee the war in Ukraine. They don't know where they're going to end up. So, and that sometimes happens. We usually think it happens in catastrophic circumstances like refugees in a war. But here, Abraham is motivated to do this because God called him to do this. And Hebrews 11 makes a point of that. So what's going to happen is that Abraham and his descendants, his immediate descendants, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, probably some great-great-grandchildren, are going to migrate through Canaan, the strip of land right here, okay, which becomes the focal point of biblical history from here to the end. They're going to migrate around Canaan. They're going to buy burial plots, but they're not going to buy land, like for settlement. They're going to be nomadic, which is not a preferable kind of state, by the way. And I will say this, that people like Abraham, who's from a highly civilized area, they're not nomadic. Nomadics are the ones who are outside of civilization. And he actually is sort of going backward in human progress to go and migrate around Canaan. So he doesn't go from country to city for the big job. He goes from city to country, and not to retire and enjoy the sunsets, by the way, like people do today. So look what's happening on the timeline. We've got the introduction of Abraham. And we're going to see here our next key passage, which is Genesis 12 and the promises made to Abraham. So this is the next major development there. So if you're plotting on your timeline, you want to make sure that you put that there. Well, Genesis 12 is critical. So turn there with me. Genesis chapter 12. And you can go ahead and put Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob there. We'll reference them a little bit later. But this is the son and grandson who are going to be in this prime lineage from Abraham to be involved in the development and the carrying out of God's plan. So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, let's talk about this next key passage, and that's Genesis chapter 12. So if you're plotting your key passage, you want to put this on your list, and then if you want to take some notes in light of Genesis 12 there on that page, that would be great. But Genesis chapter 12 is when Abraham is in Haran. He's left Ur of the Chaldees, and he's in Haran. So Genesis chapter 12, let's read this here, verses 1 to 3. Daryl, can you read that for us, please?
Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. And you, all the families of the earth, shall be blessed.
All right, thank you. The Bible is really quite economical compared to what could be in it. It's a concise collection of things revealed to us. But there is a lot of information. And at certain points, you can sort of, you know, get really, you know, sort of, you know, waist deep into it. That's why it's important to note big markers. This is a huge marker. It's like the Acts 1 reference. I'm going to jump ahead. Acts 1, Jesus is about to ascend to the Father, and he tells the apostles, you're going to be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the earth. Well, you know what happens as you go page after page in Acts? The gospel is taken to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, uttermost parts of the earth. It's like a preview of what's to come. This statement right here, Daryl just read, verses 1 to 3 of Genesis 12, is like a preview of a big chunk of the rest of the Old Testament. There is an initial kind of fulfillment, but there's an eventual fulfillment, and actually it takes us all the way to the New Testament. You can even say it's a preview of everything that's going to happen in the Bible after this. So if you can look at Genesis 12 and know what's in it, that you know what's in Genesis 12, 1 through 3, then you have your major markers for the rest of the Bible, in a way. So, first thing here, we see he does promise Abraham and his descendants land, the land of Canaan. However, Abraham does not take ownership of the land of Canaan in his lifetime. Matter of fact, all of these promises regarding their true fulfillment, Abraham will not see the complete fulfillments of these promises. So, I'm going to give you this land, family of Abraham. I'm going to make a great nation, which really means large, mighty, large and mighty. It's going to take a long time. It's going to take hundreds of years before his descendants make up a large or great nation. I'm going to make your name great. And the idea that people will know who Abraham is and that his descendants will be known, widely known, is the idea. Okay? And those who bless you, I'm going to bless them. And those who curse you, I'm going to curse you. God's going to have a protective relationship with Abraham and his descendants. So God is going to, look at this, God is going to make them his. Think about your own children, your own close friends or relatives. If somebody is good to them, you're naturally inclined to feel great appreciation and affection for that person. And somebody mistreats them, uh-oh. It really gets your back up. So it's that kind of protective relationship that God's going to have with Abraham and his descendants. And here in this text, he says that through Abraham, in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So, the door is cracked open a little bit more light's thrown in. Is this text just focused on God working just with this one man and his descendants, or is it something with a broader scope? Well, up to this point, you would tend to think that this is what God's going to do just for this people. But this is an indication that even this plan God has for Abraham and his descendants is going to eventually involve everybody. So at this point where God is really zeroing in on Abraham's family, he's got a blessing for all families through Abraham. I throw Genesis 22 up there just for reference. This is when Abraham is called to offer up Isaac and he fulfills the obligation and goes up to the point of the sacrifice and God stops him. But God reiterates this promise of blessing all people through him. And in Genesis 22, he says, all nations of the earth shall be blessed. It's a different way of putting it. All families or all nations. Well, we understand the difference between a family and a nation. But we also understand that if you say all families and all nations, that pretty much means everybody. He's using inclusive, all-inclusive language. It's a very broad kind of gathering there. And he's going to bless all people through them. Now, it's like our question back in Genesis 3. The seed of woman is going to be bruised on the heel, and the serpent is going to be bruised on the head. But we don't know exactly how this is going to happen and when in Genesis 3:15. We don't know that. Well, in Genesis 12 here and 22... how is it through Abraham God's going to bless all families and all nations? When is he going to do this? You don't know what Genesis 12 and 22. You don't know that. The door is open a little bit more. There's a little bit more light in there, but things are still very vague. We don't know. So watch how that unfolds. And This is why this is such a marker. There's so many reasons why this is such a marker in the Bible. But even think about this. There are a lot of false teachings that are built around a misconception of God's relationship with Abraham's family. God's relationship with Abraham's family is important, but to what end? The end included everybody, not just Abraham's family, ultimately. Yeah, Rick?
Well, the only, if you take Genesis 3 and Genesis 12, you see that seed promise narrow.
Seed.
It's not just the seed of woman. It's restricted to this particular family.
Right. There you go. The seed, offspring, is now narrowing down. It's not just any human. It's got to be a human in the line of Abraham. So it is narrowing. And that's what you see in the book of Genesis, especially, to some extent, through the Old Testament, but it's really happens in Genesis. It's God starts off with a few, then he's focused on many, then he's focused on a few, then in many, you know, Adam and Eve. And then the world populates, and it becomes wicked, and he focuses on Adam. I'm sorry, on Noah. And saves Noah. He starts over with them, and then the world populates again, and then he focuses on Abraham. See, God's looking over the many to find the few. And now we're beginning to see in Abraham what he's looking for in the few. Faith. That's what he's looking for. Okay? So, Abraham in God's plan here that we see in Genesis 12, 25. I don't know. We're going to zip through Genesis. Next time we're going to get into the Exodus and so forth. I just don't know of the literature in Genesis 12 to 50. And those people, and those relationships, and those family, it's just incredible literature. And, you know, we've talked about this before. If you're ever trying to get somebody interested in reading the Bible, you know, and they're a skeptic, or they're apathetic, or they're just, you know, they just don't have any understanding, just get them reading the story of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the 12 sons. If you're not fascinated by that storyline, anybody would be. It's fascinating literature. It's a fascinating narrative. It's a dramatic narrative. And it's really worth a lot of attention. Anyway, there's a lot of good sermons in here. So what we're seeing once again in the Abraham story, in the Abraham relationship, is God's looking to create his people. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. You're going to be my special possession. Special possession. Haven't we run into that recently studying in 1 Peter 2? A holy nation, a set apart people. And so Abraham becomes this pioneer of faith. Things don't start with Abraham in the Bible. They start back in Genesis 1. But we see this struggling relationship between God and humans. It's an Adam that we begin, Adam keeps popping up. It's an Abraham that we begin to see, aha, this is what God's looking for in his people. It's these Abraham qualities. Romans 4 talks about this, how that Abraham, his faith is what, you know, establishes his righteous relationship with God, okay? And so Abraham becomes, in a way, our pioneer. He leads the way, okay? It's like some of the first settlers in the western North Carolina that came in here on foot or came in here, you know, oxen pulling a wagon, and they got out and started chopping down trees and building cabins. And they're the pioneers, you know. Some of them lived up Rings Creek where I do, from what I understand, what I've read, according to a book that Ray gave me. Okay, it's where some of the first ones settled, okay? So, just think about how the wilderness here and think about what a chore that was and what an adventure it was. Well, that's Abraham. Abraham didn't just journey from Ur to Haran to Canaan. He journeyed from non-faith to faith. And even after he got to Canaan, he kept having to arrive at faith because he kept struggling to believe in the promises of God. But he kept journeying toward faith. And he becomes this model of faith for us okay? And thrown right along with it. Matter of fact, it's not like it's faith and obedience. Obedience is part of faith. It's like having a car. It's like, you know, wow, I'm going to give you this car. Great. And you get in it and you turn the key and nothing happens. You go and you pop the hood and there's no engine. I mean, what's a car without an engine? It's just a hunk of metal to sit in. So obedience is necessarily baked into faith. If we talked about Genesis 3 being a mistrust of God, it's Eve's mistrust of God, what God said to her and Adam, that led to the eating of the fruit, the disobedience. And Abraham, we're told in Hebrews 11, went out not knowing. By faith, he went not knowing. He did what God told him to do. He obeyed God by faith in going to the land of Canaan. And he was called to believe without seeing it all fulfilled. He never saw his family become a large family. He never saw the name of Abraham and his family becoming great. He never saw his family possessing the land of Canaan. But he was called to believe it anyway, as if it happened. Okay? And this is another thing you see here. And the reason I have this list up is because it helps us with our faith. He's given assurance to believe that all this is going to happen. The family will have the land. They'll be a large nation. They'll have a great name and all these kinds of things. That's going to happen in time. But like earnest money, right? What's earnest money, Andrew?
Money that's given up front as a promise for future payment or trade of something else.
Good definition. You've been to school. It's money provided up front as a promise that you're going to do more. You're going to provide more money. It's like a down payment on a house. By providing Isaac, Abraham having Isaac through his wife Sarah, that was the first step in everything that's going to happen. From Isaac will come this great nation. From Isaac will come the people who will possess the land of Canaan, and on and on and on. So Abraham wasn't able to see all of it fulfilled, and then he believed in God. God provides him with small proof to believe in the bigger things to come. I mean, that happens with us, right? None of us have been to heaven. But God's given us small things now to prepare us for the big thing later, okay? And what we're seeing here in the promises made to Abraham, God's character is on the line. As Bible readers and surveying the whole history of the Old Testament, we're going to see if this is a God who keeps his word or not. I mean, can you think of anything that reveals one's character more than when they make a promise and if they fulfill it or not, if it's within their power? And if he's God, there are no limits. He can do it if he wills it. And so these promises are staked on, his character is staked on these promises. The rest of the Bible, he fulfills those promises and he proves himself. And so God's reputation is riding on their fulfillment. And that's why you see later Old Testament characters, whether they're Moses talking to the Israelites or David writing in the Psalms, what God did for the fathers. He did this for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's given us this. He's fulfilled his word, whether it's becoming a large nation or being blessed or having the land, all those kinds of things. So, and then there, the rest of the book of Genesis from 25 to 50 focus on the sons, grandsons, great-grandsons of Abraham, mainly his sons, grandsons, great-grandsons. So these are, sometimes we call them the patriarchs. They're the heads of the descendants of Abraham. And by the time we get to the end of the book of Genesis and we're spilling over in the book of Exodus, they have become a race. So we've been reading in Exodus. Now they're a race of people. They're not just a family. They're a race of people, and they're called the Hebrews. So they're going to go from being known as Hebrews to Israelites to Jews in the biblical flow. And the blessing to be the carrier of the promises is given to one son, but there's a blessing to all the sons. And so you see that there. And so we're talking about the son of Abraham that comes through Sarah, which is Isaac. And then his son, who is Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel, means one strove with God. And then Jacob, or Israel, is going to have 12 sons. And the whole thing is going to mushroom from there. And so I just want to throw a couple of things out there. It's interesting what happens as God is fulfilling the plan, because a lot of things that are happening would cause the people at the time to think, this is not going to happen. And it causes the Bible reader to scratch his or her head. For instance, Abraham's wife is barren, and she's an old woman past childbearing years. I was willing to say something about Hilton and compare his age to Abraham. I can do that with Hilton. I'm not going to do that with any lady here in Sarah. I'm not that dumb. Okay? But Sarah is older than I think anybody in this audience when she has Isaac. I think I can safely say that. But she was barren up to that point. It's miraculous. And then Isaac's wife is barren, Rebecca, and they have to pray for her to have children, and finally she does. And then Jacob, when he comes along, son of Isaac, the woman that he really loved, Rachel, she's barren. So, I mean, it's barrenness is all through here. If this is all about the proliferation of people, you got a lot of women struggling to have babies here, which is a very unusual thing. It happens really in some strategic places in the Bible, by the way. Okay? And then there's the idea of the clash. And this is the tension in Genesis 25 to 50. The tension is these people are called to have faith in God, and oftentimes they're rascals. They lie. They deceive. They're impure. And they have to go through the process of their faith changing them. There's some few bright stars like Joseph, who has this integrity from the beginning. He's more like his father Abraham than great-grandfather Abraham than anybody, Joseph is. But oftentimes watch how their character is struggling, you know, reconciling their character with their faith. But it has to get that way. Has to get that way. And then there are all these ironies. In most civilizations, in most cultures through time, if you're talking about the next generation and who's going to have the responsibility and the blessing, who would that be in most societies? The son or the daughter? Son. And which son? The oldest, the firstborn. But the oldest doesn't always become the key person. So Esau was the first out of the womb, but Jacob, his twin, ends up getting the blessing. And there's that character and faith clash and tension, rather, tension. And you see a lot of, you know, the oldest not always being the recipient of the blessing. Who's going to be the critical person in the next generation among Israel or Jacob's family? It's not Judah and Simeon, it's Joseph. He's the critical character there. And he's the 11th son. He's not the first. And then there are these unlikely heroes that emerge and so forth. And so there's a lot of irony that goes on. And don't we go through that in our faith and in our lives? We have these moments where we're like, well, that doesn't make sense. If this is so, it should be happening this way. And it's odd how things turn out. You see those patterns in Genesis. Any other ironies that stand out in Genesis with Abraham and his family? Okay, sorry, we hit the marker there. Okay, I was trying to get 2 weeks there together. Thank you very much, and we'll jump into looking at the Exodus that we've been reading about. Thank you.